sometimes worse than just investigating your own perceptions of the word meditation, because this is a word that's used a lot these days, and it covers all kinds of things. So we think we know what we know. Generally, it means something mental, something you do with your mind. And just to observe how just a word like that, what kind of emotional reaction you have. By how I use the word emotion is the kind of reactiveness to stimulation or impingement, either like if it's on the sense through the sense organs or through the mind itself. Just like words, you can say meditation, and you might feel some sense of interest, or you might feel aversion. Like Morris Walsh was saying last night, and talked about the belly watching practice. How just something like that, back in the 50s, somebody said meditation or Burmese meditation, and then the mind would react into belly watching, waste of time, negative emotional reactions, I would call those. But those are, you know, when you're reflecting on the way things are, you can begin to see that. You can get a kind of see what happens when somebody says something, and you feel either you feel averse, or you feel threatened, or you feel interested, or you feel indifferent or confused, or you just don't know what they're talking about. At least you can be aware that that's of the power of words, concepts have on our mind. Meditation, the word itself, can also mean, it can be the way it's said. One can say meditation in a very positive way, so that it inspires, and one can say meditation in a negative way. Say, oh no, you're not going to go and meditate again, are you? There's a different one. And oh, let's go and meditate together. There's a different, just the context and the emotion or attitude behind it we feel. Every year at Amaravati we have these 2 months winter retreats for the Sangha. And at first I started at Chitters before we acquired Amaravati. And of course in those days we were a little more kind of, you know, the kind of boot camp Marine Corps style of bhikkhus. And so we thought this is, you know, kind of training for the Sangha. Get in there and really, you know, do these ascetic practices. And so I remember, kind of, this is how we started. These 2 month retreats were more like endurance marathons, and somehow in that stage of our development, we thought that was really good for people. That was really helping them. And so, winter's meditation retreat for many people was when you said there's a 2 month winter's retreat, then you see some people recoiling, you know. If I can take that again, and because their experiences on that, where it conveyed something difficult, something arduous, something painful. The whole idea of a winter's meditation retreat was an ordeal. It's hard going. So even the words are relatively neutral, aren't they? Winter's meditation retreat they're not like themselves. They're fairly neutral words. In the way one would perceive that is 2 months of, you know, sleepiness, misery, looking forward to the end of it, and, you know, trying to get something or trying to do something. So this, I remember at Amaravati giving one of these retreats, and I really, really make it difficult this year. So we sat till 11 o'clock every night, and we got up at 3 in the morning, And then I began to notice that there was a lot of sickness, and that somehow there were a certain kind of tough type of person that could take it and liked it. You know, they could you kind of prove that you can take it. But when you really asked them about insights and understanding of Dhamma after 2 months, they didn't have very much. They had maybe confirmed the fact that they were tough. But the ones that couldn't were you know, their worst fears were assured that they were weak and couldn't take it. And so that then I thought, well, this is not, you know, this is not a result. I don't like the results of this. So changing it to a different words, 2 months, winter's retreat, we still use, but now trying to use it more in a sense of supporting people in their practice rather than driving people into difficult times and pushing them in ways that many of them can't cope. But to this day, to some people, winter's retreat still contract when they hear it, winter's retreat, because of the associations from the past. So that's the power, isn't it, of association of your experience, or maybe what other people have told you. Maybe you've never been on a winter's retreat, but you've heard from somebody else how difficult it is. And so that just the word winter's retreat can... You can notice maybe some kind of feeling of contraction, or feeling that you're, you know, some negative emotional reaction. Or it can spark off a sense of, oh, I can hardly wait. Some people really live the whole year for the winter's retreat. So what I'm trying to point out is a way of reflecting on the way things are. You begin to see how, how things do affect you as an experience. Like if something shocking comes to you, some news, some unpleasant news, some surprise. If your mind, you can see a sense of shock. The body goes into a state of contraction. You kind of go like this. And even though it's maybe a brief moment, yet it does have an effect on our how we see things, how we view our lives. And sometimes we don't notice these things. We're so used to ignoring or just trying to act normal and not and try to get on with life according to our habits, that we're not really aware of the forces that have affected us in our lifetime. So breathing and the meditation on breathing, if you're really mindful of the breath, if you're using anapanasati as a way of, say, of developing mindfulness rather than just trying to concentrate and suppress everything, if you're using it as just a background, a way of composing your mind and collecting yourself in order to accept how you're feeling in the moment. So this is why to reflect on actually how you are feeling. When you say a formal meditation practice is good, it's recommended, and also in just daily life when you're in the office or in the house or whatever, and it's really very skillful to just take, even if it's a minute, just a minute to ask yourself how you're really feeling. Just to notice maybe that if you're feeling, depressed or angry or agitated or aggravated or exasperated or indifferent, positive or happy, whatever, just to note that, just to train yourself to notice without judging, without making any kind of comments about the feelings that you're having. That's unnecessary. You don't need to comment, just to notice it. And then, too, use the breath as a way of being with that feeling, the mood you're in. So in that you're sustaining, you're accepting, you're sustaining attention on the mood of that you're experiencing at this time, and concentrating on the breath help you to do that. And it's a way of getting caught in the proliferating tendencies of just making comments, emotional proliferations, and getting caught up in the thinking. Analytical functions of your mind. You're not trying to figure out why you feel the way you do. It's not necessary to figure out why you're feeling this way. It's wisdom to know this is the way you're feeling right now, and it's this way. When you start analyzing it, then it gets complicated. You know, I'm feeling upset because this person didn't do their job properly, and on. Maybe that's true, but that's not what we need to know at this time. We're not trying to make comments about the state of the world or anyone else's or one's own faults or weaknesses, but just noting, just learning to be that which knows the mood of your mind. The mood of the atmosphere you're in. Now this also, with the breath, these grounding objects like the body, the breath, I also use the sound of silence, the kind of ringing sound. If you notice, especially in the silence of a moment, you can hear kind of background ringing. It's not tinnitus. It has different, because cosmic sound, or give it a more kind of exotic title, call it the nada. This is part of the Sanskrit word for sound, but this also is a kind of, when you're aware, if you notice, as you begin to become aware of that as something you can use as a way of turning to that sound of silence, will help you to say, drop whatever you're caught up into. If you're kind of whirled away in emotional reactions and worries and proliferating tendencies, just learning to recognize the sound of silence helps to stop just the kind of that momentum that's caused that you're in. And if you sustain your attention I used to practice, say, the count of 9 or 10. I used to investigate if I was. Say, if I was in a really strong kind of state, emotional state, and then I'd be able to suddenly realize I'm really, feeling of a strong emotion. So I accept that. You accept the way you are, the emotions you're in. You're not trying to get rid of them. But once you've seen them as they are, they're this way, that's accepting. You're not making comments about, you're not going into liking or disliking. It's just this way, the way it is. And then turning to the sound of silence helps to say, let go of that particular kind of mood or emotion. And I noticed that most of the time, at the count of 10, the hardly can remember what I was upset about. Now, this is a practice of mindfulness, so it's not to be, it's not an act of repression. If we're just trying to get rid of moods and get away from things, then it doesn't work. It has to be done with the right attitude. We're not trying to just run away from our feelings or ignore these unpleasant moods or emotions, but learning how to use them, how to work with them, so that you're really using the flow of your life for your practice. It's not just your meditation practice. Is it so dependent upon ideal situations? Like if you depend on just ideal meditation situations where there's no harsh sounds and everything's kind of ordered, there's no demands made on you, there's no responsibilities at this time, or you can just come into the meditation room and sit completely silent. And that's very nice, I admit. We all like that. But then one can't live in a place like that for very long. And then most of our life isn't that under that much control. We have to learn how to meditate, how to work with life in the family or in the office, in the factory, on the London Underground, you can do it. You can actually use situations that are quite disruptive and harsh. If you determine, if you wisely reflect and see how to use maybe very difficult situations, deliberately kind of saying, this, I'm going to try to work with this, try to use this particular thing as an egotistical thing of just, well, I'm going to prove that I can overcome this. Beware of that. But if some of your life includes, say, some very difficult or stressful situations, you could, by determining to use those with mindfulness, you'll find that you can do it. You can use sometimes very, very unpleasant, unwanted experiences, and in some ways you'll even feel grateful to them, because they kind of push you to the edge where you have either you're going to crack up, give up, or use some enlightened wisdom, push you to the edge where you're forced to being wise rather than stupid. Sometimes that's what we have to do, isn't it? And I say, it's so comfortable just going along in that kind of haze of habit, and then life pushes us to the edge where we have to look at things. In the Buddhist scriptures, these are called the Devaduttas, or the heavenly messengers, in the form of old age, sickness, death, and the mendicant. Because, isn't it, all of us are, these experiences of all human beings, old age, the changing from one age to the next, So that is something that is warning us, to wake up. You don't have, when you're young, you think, oh, I've got a whole life ahead of me, I've got plenty of time. You don't even notice old people very much when you're young. You think, you're not interested in them. You want to be with young people and people that, have this kind of sense of being young forever. And then as you get older, it becomes increasingly more apparent that I like to be with older people. I don't really like being with young people. Because young people still have this belief in eternity. I mean, it's not conscious in that, but it's an attitude more than a kind of deliberate view that one is holding. It's the youthful karma. Sickness, another one. Old age, sickness, death, the loss of loved ones. That's always something that shakes us up when we lose, when our parents die, or someone, our spouse, or one of our children, or close friend, or anyone we know, or even anyone. You know, you hear that maybe some well-known figure that you don't know dies, you still feel it in a way, don't you? Because you may not know them personally, but you know about them. Then you hear about the death of all these Bosnian people, and you still feel something, even though you've never met a Bosnian in your life. At least I haven't. But they still feel there's some sense of, you know, this is a part of our human experience. But the closer death comes, like say with parents, our parents or people around us, and it has a much more strong effect on us. And that is seen as a messenger, a heavenly messenger, rather than something that is just seen in negative and depressing experience of life. And so with illness, with loss of loved ones, with the aging process, with the changing conditions, with your own sense of confusion or anxiety or worry that you have, you can work with that. Not to take the idea that you have to get rid of it. Like say with worry, we all want to get rid of worries. Most of us would like to not have to worry about anything. And so there's people say, how do I get rid of worrying? How can I stop this and not worry anymore? And so this is, you know, it's something that we all do, and that is very, very painful, unpleasant experience of life. Wherever we go, we can worry. We can be here at Leicester and worrying about what's going on at home. Read the newspaper, you're worrying about what's going to happen to Yugoslavia. You can worry about Prince Charles and Princess Diana. So be able to note that mood of worry. If you can, when you find yourself worrying, to observe, it's this to admit that there is worry now. There's this sense of worrying about something. What is it like as a mood? This is a feeling that you're having, the kind of mood that you feel now from worrying about something. It's this way. And you can, when you develop that sense of the sound of silence, you can hear the ringing silence with that mood, and the breath, and it helps to accept the way it is. You're grounded. You're with the way it is. You're not running away. You're not trying to get out of anything. There's no kind of wrong things being done. It's merely a learning how to skillfully use the experience of your life at this moment. And by doing that, more and more you're taking away the power of these negative, especially these negative tendencies of the mind. Because if you never do this, if you just suppress negativity and try to be positive about everything, you can do that so long, and then you get crushed by all the kind of tensions you create in trying to get away from negativity. It all comes, sometimes rebounding and back in backlash of just feeling total despair and depression because of so much effort in trying to be happy and positive. But with this, say, this type of way of meditating, you can, you're releasing your karmic connection to these forces. You're not making, by abandoning them, by letting go, by understanding, you're actually not making any personal karma with them. Say, karma, when you make karma, you're doing it when you indulge in it and when you suppress it. Those are the karma-making ones. Indulgence and suppression. But mindfulness allows what has arisen to cease. You're actually letting what has come up in your consciousness, what you're experiencing in consciousness, you're letting it go, you're letting it cease. So it's even compassionate. It's like you're suddenly just being very, very kind. Say before you were, when you thought you were kind, you weren't. Any kind of negative state came up and you just kind of push it away. Or you just get caught in it and make yourself miserable and make other people miserable and then you're trying to suppress it, get rid of it. So you're endlessly having a battle with yourself, with the negative tendencies of your mind. And in any battle, there's always these tensions and you can, you know, when you're healthy and that, you can suppress things a lot easier. But then in your health, you lose your health or as you get older and things like this, your ability to control and suppress diminishes, which is a good thing. Don't think it's just you're getting senile and useless. Old age has its advantages. In fact, you don't have that energy to control and hold things back. So you, instead of just becoming caught in just these emotional reactions, you use them and as skillful means for resolving your karma, letting it go. So from the ground, you notice to reiterate the breath, the body, the sound of silence. These will ground you. They'll bring you into the present. You can here and now Dhamma. This is the way it is now. Because these things are happening right now. This is the way it is now. Or for all of us, it's not individual anymore. Not personal. Then, say, as you, and this will also help you to look at what is personal in a way that you're looking at it as an object rather than as the person who has become these conditions. So your feelings of anger or resentment or greed or confusion, rage, jealousy, all of these can be, you're seeing them as a mood, as a feeling, as something that has arisen. And that which can see them is what? That which knows, you see. That's what I call the refuge in the Buddha. That ability to know things as they are. That never gets depressed or angry. It knows anger, it knows depression as an object. And so at any moment, there's this, say, in refuge in Buddha, there's this, just that act of knowing it, of accepting it for what it is. is not that. That's a clarity. That's mental clarity. That's Buddha. That's using our conscious experience with wisdom. And therefore, whatever you're feeling, you can accept it. You're no longer taking it personally, and therefore you're no longer complicating your mind with moral judgments, disparaging views, or feeling of despair. If you have anger or maybe not very nice feelings, and if you take it personally, then you end up feeling despair or feeling that you're not a very nice person. But seen from this way, you're seeing it as you're developing it as path knowledge, as the middle way. Now, even though you can understand what I'm saying, there's still the doubting mind will come in, and your conditioned mind will always be making comments about this, because it's conditioned to doubt and to have a go at you and make you and try to delude you. So really be aware of that tendency of doubting or not being sure. You doubt what you're doing. Am I doing it right? Am I really being mindful? Is this what Ajahn Sumedho was talking about? well, come in, to kind of delude you and make you get you carried away with being confused and uncertain. In the suttas, the Buddha was, even after his enlightenment, Mara would come and tempt him. Don't forget that. Don't think, even after his enlightenment, Mara would have a go, seeing if he could get the Buddha to doubt something. And the Buddha would always say, I know you, Mara. That way of knowing, isn't it? It's, this doubting, these kind of subtle feelings that we can have in our life. Oftentimes worldly things can be so important. Worldly problems have such can be so important in themselves, they have great, and we empower them all the time. The worldly conditions can seem so urgent. You feel you have to really be concerned with this. You have to be worried about this. If you're not worried about the state of the world or worried about the problems of your family, you're not a caring, loving, responsible person. The worst fears of your family is that you become one of those Buddhists that goes off and sits under a tree, meditates on their belly, and doesn't care anymore about what happens to the family or the world. Doesn't care what happens to Britain or anything else. It's just you've just gone beyond it, and that's people do see that as accuse us of doing that, because the world does seem important, and our family's problems are important to us. But importance, recognize that importance and urgency are conditions that arise in consciousness. So in this way of reflection, we're not saying that something isn't important. We're not denying the importance of any worldly issue or worldly condition, but we're putting it in a perspective that we're not just kind of emotionally mesmerized and deluded by the urgent, important quality of a worldly condition. Have you ever had anybody come up to you? There was one monk, I remember, he used to have this sense of urgency all the time. Whenever he said anything, he had this kind of force behind his presentation. He used to come up to me and he says, Ajahn Sumedho. Yes. Ajahn Sumedho, did you know that that monk has been going off, leaving the monastery in the afternoon without telling any of the senior monks? Suddenly, you can see your mind going, how dare he? That's caught in the the power this monk could make something like that sound so, you know, so urgent, and you've got to do something about it. You can't stand for this. This has gone too far. And then you find yourself so easily pulled into that. It's the power of somebody else's feelings. And so maybe that one, I mean, but sometimes there are situations that are a very urgent and very important, and we have to make immediate decisions about them. But that doesn't. But this kind of meditation doesn't deny that, or it's not suppressing that, but it's putting it in a perspective in which you're much more capable of dealing with it than just being caught into a kind of panic and the power of somebody else's mood or the worldly condition in its kind of urgent quality. You can develop a coolness and an openness to it, in which you're much more able to respond to urgent situations if you're not just blinded by the power of a worldly condition. So we train ourselves, in the monastery we train ourselves, we use these situations, and more you find monastics becoming more, not being so easily deluded by the problems of the Sangha and the panic and the hysteria that sometimes various members are experiencing. It's like with the saying yesterday with the monks, several monks disrobing, and then the panic. It's falling apart. It's not working. This kind of thing is. I was quite pleased to see how many members of the Sangha could work with that feeling. Oh, is there? Because I mean, in some way, all of us were feeling that. But it was when things don't seem to go right, or suddenly kind of surprising, unwanted things happen. It's easy to go into that state of panic, and to use that feeling of being panic-stricken, or that is good practice, because if you really accept the feeling of it, and use the breath and the sound of silence with it, you can put it in its perspective. The energy will cool down. You'll not be caught in just acting blindly on that kind of emotional experience. And then you realize that life is like this. People, monks ordain, monks disrobe. The breath goes in, the breath goes out. What comes together separates. That's just the law of nature. Then you can see any attachments, like, I don't want monks to disrobe, I want them to stay. Or you can see, you know, your own personal kind of, how could he do that to me? We've been friends for so long and he just does that. How could he do that to me? You're seeing it in perspective of as it is. It's you're accepting the way it is, and it's also reflecting the way it is, like your own personal feelings or whatever. Then we noticed like when these monks disrobe, then some people are trying to be very honorable and noble about it. You know, we must remember all the good they've done for the Sangha. So you're sitting there and somebody says, well, I'll always think of him as my first meditation teacher. He helped me so much. All those years he spent in helping the Sangha grow here in England. Going to the let's be noble and understanding and forgiving, which is also very good. But also, one has to recognize how you're actually feeling. You know, so that there's two. There's how we should feel. How we should respond, And then there's the actual way you're feeling, which might be very different. And we might think, yes, I must forgive, and we all make mistakes, and he you know, is a very good monk and gave a lot to the sangha, which is true. And then the feeling of, then the feeling of, how could he do that? It was a rotten thing to do. So when you see that we feel both, there's a side of us that's very noble and wants to be very understanding and very good about it, which is to, you know, something to value in yourself. I'm not trying to put that down or make fun of it, but recognize that's one aspect, that's one way of feeling it. But you also want to accept the way you maybe feel about it on another level, of just emotional disappointment, or the way you tend to, where you can blame yourself. Maybe you can say, maybe I should have been more aware of that maybe there was something wrong. Maybe I should have been more understanding. The sense of blaming yourself or thinking you didn't do enough, self-blame, or then the tendency to blame the person. Like, well, he knew better than that, and he just, you know, just despicable behaviors, betraying the sangha. And so that these are things one can feel these in various ways, in different attitudes, from the noble forgiveness and understanding and gratitude to the very personal feeling of betrayal and disillusionment. But recognize that you're accepting the whole lot. It's not up to you to choose which one you're going to feel right now. You're noticing what you're actually feeling. Even if you're feeling terribly hurt and personally disillusioned, but you don't want to be like that. Maybe you don't want to be that kind of a person. You'd rather be like, you know, the very noble one. And you can see these are just the emotional reactions to a situation, and you're accepting them accepting them non-judgmentally. And then the way we respond is to do what is right. We determine to, in our active side of life, we determine to do what is right, what is the good and proper way to respond to this situation. Maybe we don't want to do it. Some part of us doesn't want to do what's right. We want to, maybe, you know, I have a tendency to want to seek revenge. So I mean that's one of my tendencies. I want to make them pay for it, but that's not what I'm going to do. That's not what I intend to act upon. But one can admit those kind of feelings and resolve them. In that way you can see you're liberating your mind from holding things, or dishonesty, or refusal to really admit how you're feeling, and or being afraid to. Maybe you're afraid of your own feelings, so you just, you know, I don't dare feel that because you feel you'd be taken over by some kind of negative state. But you can take, you can, you feel, when you trust in this practice, you can feel, you're willing to feel it. And by doing that, it has no power. It can't take you over. It has no, you're disempowering it. Not as an act of, not as a willful act to destroy, but delusion, ignorance has power over you. As long as it keeps you deluded, doesn't it? Fear. If I can make you afraid of me, I have power over you. But as soon as you're not afraid of me anymore, I don't. That's how tyrants work. They keep you in a state of, you know, fear, and then they have tremendous power to manipulate you. And like you could see as Soviet communism. How could that lasted from what 1918 to 1991 or 1990, and it was using fear, which, you know, to frighten everybody into. Everybody was frightened. Nobody dared complain or do anything to resist or rebel. Because there was, for one thing, when under Stalin, they just murdered millions of people. And that's frightening, isn't it? I mean, that when once you know that, I mean, everybody must have been affected by that in some way in the Soviet Union. You know, and that could happen to me. So you shut up and you just go along with whatever, just to survive. And now you see suddenly it collapses, because that kind of thing is, you can't sustain anything. It's out of balance. You can only use methods like that and control people for, you know, for a certain amount of time, and then it doesn't work anymore, because people suddenly awaken. They're not going to put up with it. They're not going to, you can't intimidate or frighten them anymore. They'll resist. And one feels that in the world now that there is more of that happening, like these people demanding their rights and people not willing to just be oppressed so easily by tyrants. And apply that also within yourself, like the internal tyrant, that in you which is always kind of pushing and nagging and criticizing. I mean, we do it to ourselves. It starts from in here. But we also we oftentimes, you know, we're doing that. That tyranny starts from within the mind. Not that it just suddenly happens that somebody, some external person, tyrant arrives. That's the result of an inner tyranny that has never been recognized or resolved. And as long as people are subject to that, then you can tyrannize them externally. But awakened people, you know, awakened human beings, the Buddha is the awakened one. It's a symbol for a human being who's awake. I don't mean just awake, not asleep, but awake, I mean aware, seeing things as they are. Because otherwise, we, even though we think we're awake, we're caught in momentum of habitual, of our habits. We just, it's, you can see how easy it is just to, whenever you feel threatened or anxious or ill at ease, what do? You tend to eat something, or drink something, or watch the television, or go for a ride in the car, or talk to somebody on the telephone. Or, I mean, there's some way to distract yourself from that feeling of just not being certain, or ill at ease, or despairing in some way. And then maybe, you know, in a crisis or difficult thing, we're frightened of what others think. We're worried about being blamed. We dread being criticized or humiliated or exposed to others. There's this tremendous fear. As long as we don't resolve these kind of fears, then we can be manipulated, blackmailed, and controlled, both internally and externally. So that the aim of the Buddha was to awaken the human being to what their true nature is. So your true nature is not ignorant, deluded, worried, frightened. That's not what you are. When you think you are those things, then of course you tend to become like that. The becoming process, you act like that, you react like that. But as you see it in the light of Dhamma, then And you're not, you realize it's not you. It's anatta, not self. It's not mine. Think like in, say, just monastic life, say, as a layman, I was brought up in a very kind of Christian family. So my parents were very morally responsible people and very good Christians. But also, one was brought up in a world that was idealized, and one tended to identify with very high and noble goals for oneself. And then, because of this, the dark side, as they say in modern psychology, was suppressed. Because you find out, especially in puberty, and as you're getting older, you there's some side of you that frightens you, and you can become quite paranoid about it. I remember when I was about 12 years old or something, I was on public transport, I lived in Seattle, and suddenly I had this overwhelming desire to do the most atrocious things, like murder babies and do really horrendous kind of atrocities. And so I thought, that's terrible, you know. I thought, there must be some evil force in me. I must be a bad person. Because only bad people would ever have such impulses. I couldn't imagine a good person ever having such an impulse or thought. And so I remember being very terrified by that. And I didn't do anything with it. I didn't go and murder anyone. But it did shock me into realizing there is something, you know, frightening about life that I never saw before. And then at that age, it's very personal. You take it on a very personal level. So there's this tremendous fear of myself after that. Fear of things that were in me that might, that would, if let loose, would be very destructive. So then unfortunately I didn't have very much of that, but there were certain, you know, unresolved things in one's life that and say before I became a monk led to just a feeling of being very unfulfilled in life and very frightened and anxious about the future and very depressed, really. By the time I was 30, I felt just a general despair and depression and disappointment. Then in monastic life, with the effect of meditation, these things were resolved. These, when one could put them in a perspective that you can accept them. And they're all part of your, they're all seen in terms of Dhamma. They all help you to liberate your mind. Even such atrocious thoughts as that, seen in the perspective of Dhamma, are still conditions arising and ceasing, so they all take you to cessation and to realization. So then you can have confidence that whatever you're feeling, you can feel, and you can look at it in its way of Buddha seeing the Dhamma, which, and if you trust in that, if you really take refuge in that, then there's nothing to fear. Because the fear comes on the personal level, isn't it? It's the fear of being overwhelmed by these things, or the fear of maybe one's something is wrong with oneself, or fear of being weak, or fear of the aging process, or sickness, or death. All these fears come from the attitude of a self. The illusory self-view, and then in terms of Dhamma, they're all seen as developing the middle way, the Eightfold Path. See, so you change it. Very, it can shift just from me and mine and my problems to the Eightfold Path. And recognize that karma of our humanity is that we have to accept the way it is, the human body. You have to accept your body the way it is. You don't have to, but I recommend. which is not loving or hating it. It's just this way. And so you like in Gayanupassana, you really with your body and with its pain or with its discomforts or whatever, or with it, because it also can be quite pleasurable thing. So it's but the body is this way. You're reflecting on the body as Dhamma rather than commenting it as self, commenting upon it as yourself. Then the Vedana Jitta of looking at mental attraction, aversion, and neutral conditions that impinge on you and that you experience, and then the mood, the emotional mood of the mind, positive, negative, indifferent. Then you can then with the breath, the sound of silence. So this then you have through this way of reflecting. Then all the personal karma can be seen in terms of Dhamma. What arises ceases, and letting what you're feeling right now is what has arisen, isn't it? What you're conscious of at this moment is what has arisen already. Like if you're feeling whatever you're feeling right now. And if you accept it, that which has arisen, you can let it go and it ceases. So there's a knowing of its presence and its absence. And then this way, this is the refuge of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, you are practicing, you are the Supatipanno, or the one who's practicing in the right way. Any questions?
It can be very shaky, can't it, when thoughts arise? Like you said, when you thought about killing babies and stuff like that, but at 12, I mean, that's kind of in a way. And sometimes we're in situations where we definitely think we should behave differently. We do have power over behaving, but we don't necessarily have the power over that thought as it first breaks. And I'm wondering whether, I know for myself sometimes, living in a community that's similar to in the same, I have great empathy there. Sometimes thoughts arise that you don't really think in a rational way, but you should be capable of thinking.
I know, but I consider that an improvement, because I realize. Because that means your meditation is having a good effect. You're willing to accept things that before you wouldn't accept. I mean, look at your life. When you had more control of your life, living in outside the community, then there's a lot of you have more. You can control things a lot better, according to the way you want life to be. In a community like Sharpen, you have to more or less take it as it is, and that would also release a lot of maybe. Emotions that you've never had to really look at, but by that, by seeing it in a positive way, you let them go. You're resolving those things.
It's surprising sometimes how deep they can come. Yeah.
Well, like I saw when my father died, he was 90, and he'd been a man that had always controlled everything very much. And he was very good on the worldly things. Like he was very well organized and could do things well and keep everything in order. And so on the worldly level, he's successful, and he had confidence, very very confident. But as he got older, and the last 10 years of his life were utter hell because he lost the ability to control things, and he just got depressed. He didn't have much internal resource. To him, Christianity was external ceremonies. They were high church Anglicans, and he was master of ceremonies, and he trained all the altar boys, and you know, he was an expert on ceremony in Anglo-Catholic Church in America. And so but as far as internalization of Christianity, there, I don't think there's hardly anything. And I just watched the last 10 years of his life. He had good health up till about 80, and then it all started collapsing, and there was bitterness and anger, and more and more he became childish, and he was a man who had, you know, always impressed me as being, you know, the kind of strong, confident male figure that has all the answers and nothing, you know, knows what he's doing. Suddenly, he's just collapsing and weeping and whining and blaming and all the rest. So it's a pretty, very sad to see. But you see, he never resolved those things. When it got to be, you know, getting into his 80s, he didn't know how to resolve them. And he ended up being almost totally paralyzed, you know, not being able to move. But so that's why I see in our own lives, sometimes you will feel the kind of like baby-like emotions coming up. You know, you know, on the level of being your self-image, it's rather disconcerting. you'd like to not have to feel those things, but in another way, it's a purification, because a lot of that stuff has been just held down and is not allowed to surface until maybe it's too late. But say, at your age, it's the perfect age for releasing. Resolving them.
You had a wonderful opportunity of observing your parents.
What is it in people that try to goad you into anger? As a teacher, I have gone into the school for it, and I think this is going to be a calm day. And there's always quite a few people who know how to, you know, get at me and do it. Just to make me lose my cool all the time. Is that good for you? It's always used to happen. And you know, it was to get you off your dignity, to bring you down, really. You know? And it was fun.
For them, not for
you. Mean children did, or adults?
I mean, children do more obviously than adults. I expect adults to
Yeah, well, children love to get the adults going.
And adults can play power games, which can be You also see people who are afraid of children.
Quite right. It seems to be a
afraid of teenagers.
I'm always presented with anger in a similar situation to about expressing it. I say there are times I've had, certainly in my work, where it's actually quite important to indicate actually that, you know, this point beyond which you can't go, and it's how to express it whilst being aware of what the emotion is, but being effective, but not being
But that's also, I mean, that's a very good point you're making. Also, like, it's all right to tell people, but I'm angry.
Yes.
I mean, because that, in a way, that's important to people to know that, because some people don't are so insensitive, they don't even notice. And so if you never tell them, then they, I mean, sometimes, you know, we all sometimes are so caught up in what we're doing, we don't realize that we might be driving somebody in, you know, really into a lot of anger. And that kind of feedback helps, I think, other people. I found it helpful when people tell me those things, because sometimes you don't realize that what you're saying or doing is something that is causing them a lot of grief. Yes. But to say it, try, you know, make your determination, your intention, one of saying it rather than just using it as a against the person, you see. Then that's honest and skillful.
But you can tell someone that you're angry, and it's like water off a duck's back.
Yeah.
You know, they laugh at you, and they don't really mean it because you don't get angry, but you say, I am angry. And it isn't until you actually sort of show, not just tell them, it seems sometimes, you actually have to show that you are. You are in that angry emotion. Now, who that's good, bad, or what it is, but sometimes it's the only thing that works.
Right.
And, I have a 97-year-old mother, you know, and it's like a small child sometimes. And she will laugh at me and say, you're not angry. But I am. And then you feel like you are. You go outside and punish yourself because you've shown that you're angry. But I think sometimes it is the only way to get there.
Right.
In the perfect world, it would be lovely to just say that I'm angry and people would understand it. Or that you were really hurt or upset by something, you know, that has happened to you. And they haven't deliberately done it, but when they do it again the second time, or maybe the third time, and you've spoken about it, well, then something just flares, isn't it? And that way, sometimes it does get through, whether that's right or not, I don't know.
Well, that you have to, you know, the thing, like what I've been talking about is to try to work with these things, but also we have to trust in the situation itself. You know, in the heat of the moment or the actual moment as is, we have to trust in our response to it. And sometimes we maybe make the wrong, we react badly or whatever, but then we learn. You know, you keep not to get caught in despair, because your ideal is not to show anger, and then you do, because then you're always, you know, every time you show anger, you're going to feel, oh, I'm hopeless. But if you reflect on it, and sometimes that's showing anger is helpful, because it really, you know, like a child walking across a thoroughfare, you know, you have to really make it clear that they can't do that, you know, in kind of physical ways. And the kind of people that think you should never hit a child, you know, ideally, you know, that's an ideal that is, you know, based on good intentions. But sometimes a good slap is a very helpful thing. It's just if you know and it makes makes your point clear. People sometimes don't hear you unless you do really put a lot of exclamation marks.
Yeah, I make this experience quite often. You know, when I'm really angry, I can't help it. I just burst, and then I think, oh, well, I've gone too far. But then in the end, it has a clearing effect, because the other person realizes, oh, she is angry, and that clears the whole thing.
Because with anger, if you don't know how to deal with it, then you really end up, you just become neurotic and suppressed, and then it comes out in various distorted ways, neurotic ways. Where I think all of us understand anger, don't we? It's something every human being experiences.
But somehow you feel it's wrong when it's blind anger. Sometimes it rushes up on you, it bursts before you. And that's when you feel so rotten up. You know, I should have seen it coming. And you don't, sometimes. But that's it.
Right.
It's happened, it's over, and that was that moment.
Does that get changed with age?
But it's a question, I think, of limiting the effect of the anger rather than the anger itself.
I think
that
there's some.
I have a rule in meetings in work that anger is okay, providing only one person at a time gets angry.
That's fine while you're controlling the situation. You're
going to
control it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But since all the emotions get a bit dimmed and spot on with age, I think that too.
Perhaps you spend more time making other people happy when you're
up. Yes, the more one realizes the one is thrown by idiots.
I was absolutely furious once. We had a community relations meeting, and a lot of people came in, I think, to make trouble deliberately, because it was an Asian speaking in a chair and so on. And to find people insulting the people that you respect tremendously, mm-hmm. and feeling absolutely unable to do anything about it without making more trouble. You didn't want to send for the police, if at all possible. And you know, I was absolutely boiling. And then I thought, well, what can I do? And invite that objectionable in front of me, this young man, to come and have a cup of coffee with me afterwards. If he's on his own, he won't be as troublesome. Well, I mean, it'll be a one-to-one business rather than, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, my anger disappeared like that when I could think of something to do about it. The only trouble was at the end, there were two older men at the back who were inciting these younger ones. If the police had come in, of course, the police would have gone for the younger ones, and the old men at the back would have got out of it. So I went and told them what I thought of them. By that time, this young man that I was going to take out for a cup of coffee had disappeared. Yes. And once he got outside, I couldn't tell t'other from which. At least it did resolve my anger, which isn't often I feel furious like that. But at the same time, I felt I'd learned something by the situation. Find something positive, if you can, to do about it. I'm only sorry that I wasn't able to. But there we are. It was a solution for the time being, anyway.
Like indignation. There's a lot of, I think, many of us have had to work with that, the sense of just, you know, seeing unfairness or...
It's just nauseous in a way.
Really, you know, ugly nastiness. And injustice, and one can get really outraged at that. But that's what all this is when once we begin to work with it, you see, then we find out ways of dealing with it, of responding to because each situation is unique. You know, you can't make a rule and say I will always do this, because you have to take into, like, mindfulness allows you to take into the contributing cooperative causes of a situation. Like, you can't say, like the old question about to conscientious objectors, what would you do if your mother was being attacked by a maniac? And I mean, but that also has cooperating causes around it, and so you can't make, you can't say what you do in a situation where those causes aren't present. But if you're mindful, you can, by being aware of the existing causes, you can respond in a way that isn't just a reaction based on aversion, but would be, say, appropriate to that particular circumstance. Because what happened to you was a good thing to do. Would have, you know, even though you couldn't do it the way they did, you did resolve that feeling in yourself, because you saw how to, you know, what would be the right way to respond to it. Where maybe before that you just wanted to say, get out of here, we don't want you.
That's right.
We don't want you here.
I'm only sorry, I couldn't carry it through though, because I'm quite sure if I listened to what he said, and then you'd sort of put in a few ideas, did you know about so, did you know about something else? I mean, he'd been fed ideas by all these other troublemakers, really, hadn't he?
Well, I remember in when I was a child, we lived in a part of Seattle where most of us were white Protestants and middle class people, and then there was, and amongst those, there's always a measure of anti-Semitism. So that there were also Jewish people at that time in the 40s that. Jews moving over from escaped Europe, and they would come and live in our neighborhood. Then I noticed that there was some of the children had these anti-Semitic feelings towards the Jewish children. And fortunately, my parents were not anti-Semitic, so they would never let me talk in that way. So I remember going home and saying something anti-Semitic, my parents saying, you should never say that, that's very wrong, and so forth. So they didn't say it in anger, but they were telling me that was not right. And so then because of that, I would, when I'd go out and play the other children, and they'd talk about it, I'd say, that's not right, you shouldn't talk that way. And after a while, all of them stopped doing it, and we started the children, Jewish children were playing with us, you know, just as ordinary children playmates. But it just through that kind of suggestion, and children are open, but if you just keep affirming such prejudices, then they have no way of seeing through it. Then once you started playing together, then you were relating to each other as individuals rather than...
But still...
And suddenly the old Jewish question is a non-problem, disappeared.
May I tell a little story? How a long time ago, we had a spaniel, we lived in Kent. And one day, our eldest son, not very old, he was about 10. And he'd taken his homework into the lounge, which he should not have done. My husband was very particular about these things. They had to do their homework at the proper place. And I think he was terribly fond of the children, actually, but he tried. He tried his best. Anyway, Mike was doing his homework. And he got the pen and flipped it, annoyance, at the wallpaper. Well, the wallpaper was quite new. It had recently moved in. So I frantically said, take that pen out quickly, Michael. And frantically tried to put something in where the awful flash was. So when my husband came in, they were all together, and there was just the radio in those days, not television, wasn't awful. Oh yes, I'm sorry, you've got a television, comes with a story. So when my husband came in, I was a little nervous, and I do hope he doesn't see this terrible splash of ink. I was trying to get a good bread crust. And anyway, he came in, and he noticed. That's what he noticed, what Michael had been doing. And then, he noticed, most of us noticed the splash, and very old splash. And he stopped, you know, really being really cross. Why the hell have I stopped with him? Why this, why that? And the atmosphere was getting very angry. The television was on, and our spaniel had come in. And during the time that he was going on, we hadn't noticed him until Sunday. Christopher, my other son, started to laugh. And he said, "You're a kiddie." And there was an investment ball, which went up and down. He was sitting in front of the television, and the whole situation was dissolved. We've never said any more about you.
Yes. I would have been glad my son was doing homework anyway. But that's a generation or two difference, I guess.
It's a bit like pain. If you have a severe pain, you sort of provide a pain somewhere else. Like the old theory of cupping and leeches.